step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Truth Be Told.
That not only are there reptilians here,
new evidence of UFO fleets.
We were close to nuclear war.
To help you transform so that you can live your highest truth.
We're not being told just because we're not ready for it.
Geostations of frequency, vibrational.
I was a homicide detective with LAPD.
UFOs increase. Visitations. Petroglyphs. What is a petroglyph? Is it like the art gallery of the world, or does it have a bigger meaning, maybe a history book? Well, today we have author Carol Nervig and her book, The Petroglyphs of Mu, Pompeii, Nan-Madal, and the Legacy of Lumeria. Today we're going to talk about symbols of the Pompad petroglyphs have exact counterparts in other ancient cultures throughout the world. How does this happen? It includes hundreds of Pompad petroglyphs and stone circles, many which have never been seen. And we're going to talk about her residing in a small Pacific island of Pompeii, where Carol discovered a brush fire exposed hundreds of previously unknown petroglyphs carved on gigantic boulders. Lots to discuss, a lot of new discovery, and I'm excited to have Carol on the show today. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome to the Truth Be Told studios for the first time, author Carol Nervig. Hello, Carol.
Hello, Tony.
Well, welcome from Ecuador.
I should say hola.
Hola, yeah. For people don't know, Carol lives in Ecuador now. So did you learn Spanish before you went to Ecuador, or did you learn once you moved there?
Well, no, not before I moved here. And it's very embarrassing. I get by, but hola, that's pretty good. Get by, but unfortunately, I really haven't taken the time. And when I finish my writing, then I'll be able to focus on that a little bit more.
That's great. Well, because I have a green screen up, this won't look so well. But the book itself, I have a copy here, and for great. Everybody out there, they can get it on Amazon and different types of websites, Inner Traditions, and all kinds of different things like that. You can purchase the book. But first of all, tell us what the book is about, and then we'll go back to figure out how your journey started with the petroglyphs.
The book is about a petroglyph site on the island of Pompeii in Micronesia. And I was just mentioning to Tony about, it's a little bit confusing, so I'll just start with that. The island, the name of the island is Pompeii, and the name of the petroglyph site is very similar, Pompeid. And so it's, there are many confusing things, but certainly that. And I did want to, Pompeii, the name of the island, is literally translates to pon means upon, and pay means a stone altar or a basalt, columnar basalt altar. So the name of the island is Pompeii, and many Pompeians believe, their island is sacred, and its name's named accordingly. So on this map.
There, I'll redo that so you can see it.
Yeah. The petroglyph site, it's on the right side of the map. You see that large bay.
Right.
Water coming in. That's Madeline Bay. And at the end of the bay where the road goes around, that's approximately where the petroglyph site is. So my book is about this site and how I, you know, my personal journey in finding it and then writing about it. And then those are narrative chapters, and they alternate with more left brain chapters, facts and figures and oral history about the site itself. So the petroglyphs at this site are unusual because they're not really similar to other Pacific petroglyphs, and there really aren't that many petroglyphs in the Pacific region on the islands.
Right.
And they're, but any number of them are similar to others found worldwide in ancient, often more sophisticated civilizations.
Now, that's what I think is more interesting than a lot of other locations around the world, because some petroglyphs are very specific to that region or that area. But you're saying that these petroglyphs have influence from other cultures around the world, which is amazing if that's true. Was that like a vacation destination or something?
Not for me. It's too hot and humid to be vacation for me. But of course, I lived there two different times. The question is, well, first of all, the site itself has two areas, two components. One is a huge, enormous basalt rock outcrop. And on that outcrop are a number of petroglyphs. In fact, the ones behind you, Tony, are from that outcrop.
Oh, okay.
And those are the more, you know, I call more simplistic ones. Came across was the petroglyphs on this. It's kind of an interesting story. I don't know if you want to get into how I found them or talk.
No, I want to find. Yeah, I would love to, because that story in itself is interesting. How it was discovered.
Well, you know, I was there originally in the Peace Corps, mm-hmm. and I was when I saw the Nan Madol site. I was just blown away and it was amazing because we took a boat after our Peace Corps training. They put us all in two or three boats and we had to leave in the middle of the night because to get through the reef, you had to, and to get around Nan Madol, you had to be at high tide because it's built on a reef. So we got there. It was still, that's exactly the area we entered.
That's
there's
beautiful.
Kind of a little pier in front of that. Good choice of photos. but it was still pitch black. And so we just sort of sat around on the stones until the sun rose. And the sun rose and it was like, oh my God, we're surrounded by these 40-foot walls and this basalt. And it was really amazing. But my other emotion at the time was, you know, I was angry. It was like, what? Why doesn't the world know about this site? This is amazing. It's like nothing else. And so that prompted me to, during the summer when I wasn't working, I interviewed I had two Pohnpeian informants, elders that were the experts on Nan Madol. And so I recorded their oral histories on the site. And that's the corner of Nandoas.
That is huge. Is that a wall?
Yeah. Yes. Some of the some of the longer basalt columns are 23, 25 feet long. And in the corner of that complex, there's the largest stone, and it's or megalith actually. It's not columnar basalt. It's more of a natural stone, but it weighs like 54 tons. Hmm. So just the engineering there in itself was mind-boggling.
Right.
I interviewed Masao Hadley and Pensi Lawrence and created this little booklet on Nan Madol not many, but a few archaeological reports, but that wasn't really for general public consumption and certainly not for the Pompeians. So that's how my addiction to Pompeii began. Anyway, after Peace Corps, I returned to the U.S. and did my business. And about midlife crisis time, I decided I sold my business, moved back to Pompeii to start a nonprofit called the Nan Madol Foundation to get funding for preservation and protection of the site. And that was kind of unique because that was the first nonprofit ever on the island. Well, except for churches. Anyway, that brought me back. I returned to Pompeii in 1990 to do the nonprofit. And while I was there, there was a conference at South Pacific Regional Environmental Program. And they had a conference and they invited me to speak on Nan Madol for the conference. And then later on that evening, it's a tiny place and there are a handful of restaurants. So we all end up eating in the same place and having dinner and so forth. And one of the consultants, I'm not sure if he was a geologist or what, but his avocation was petroglyphs. He was, he loved petroglyphs and he made it a point to see them wherever he went. So he started asking me, well, are there any petroglyphs on the island? And I said, well, yes, there's some at this outcrop. And they were well known and I'd been there, I don't know how many times myself. And I wasn't too excited about going because I'd been there.
Right.
And it was so hot and humid and going, I said, look, and he kept bugging me. I said, look, you rent an air conditioned car and I'll go. I'll take you there. So he did. And we went. And so we got to the site. We walked down the path. There's kind of a fork in the path and you go left to the outcrop. And we stopped there and looked to the right. And there was this huge, the meadow was all burned off. And I'd never seen these stones there. And the reason it was burned is there was a drought on the island. And Pompeii gets 400 some inches of rain a year.
Wow.
Similar to Kauai.
Right.
And so the fact that there's a drought was unheard of. And so the kids, what they did, they just went out and into the field with matches and discovered it burned. So they just burned this whole area off. It was amazing. So we walked, of course, we headed toward, and some of them were huge. And we approached this one the consultant from ANU, he was ahead of me. And so he said, Carol, come and look at this. And it was covered with petroglyphs. And I was like, oh my God. I mean, it was just unreal. And we both climbed to the top of it, of this huge boulder. And I actually didn't realize till afterwards, looking at the photos, that the shape of this was, I refer to it in the book as a phallic boulder, because that's what it looked like. And it's not uncommon in some other cultures to have stones like that.
Right, right.
So that's how we found it. And we were both stunned. I mean, we were walking around from one rock and one megalith to the next and taking some photographs. But in hindsight, I wish I would have taken way more.
Right. Now, was this discovery, how soon after the burn that it was discovered? Were you kind of one of the first people to discover it, or was this, or the locals already knew about it, or?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's not the people that live right there. Of course, they knew it was burned, and they knew there were the family that owns the property. They knew there were petroglyphs. Mm-hmm. I mean, the main outcrop, everybody knew that.
Right.
And they knew that there were some other rocks. But that's why I say this site is much older, because they don't know what the site was for. They didn't know the meaning of any of the petroglyphs.
Oh, really?
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, they didn't. And even the ones on the outcrop, I mean, nobody's really, the only oral history that exists is how the site was created. And that refers to the outcrop portion. And that legend is these two young brothers from the neighboring district of Kitty. They stole a blanket. And so they're running away to escape with this blanket. And they took the blanket to this site and they put it down, and that became the petroglyph site. Hmm. And so, you know, if there were patterns or designs on the blanket, maybe that's how they would explain that. And so, but eventually these two young men are brothers or whatever, they were there, and then there was a doorway inside of this outcrop. And so they left via this doorway into the rock.
Mm.
Love it.
Well, you know, I'm just so people can have a perspective where this is actually located, there's a map. So it is out in the middle of the Pacific. It's above, you know, Australia, and it's a ways from any location. So the history of this little island, the locals that, you know, born and raised there, you're saying that didn't even know how to decipher or how to read these petroglyphs. So do they think it was a whole different culture before theirs?
Well, yes, they said they were people that came before.
Right.
I mean, and one thing about oral history and local accounts, you know, there's a dozen versions of any particular thing, depending on who you talk to and what migration they came on or what family. So the creation, that was one that commonly accepted oral history. The other is, at the fork in the road, you go either to the meadow or to the outcrop. And at that location, there's a Takai and Pasu. And Takai means rock. Mm-hmm. Pasu means clam in Pohnpeian language. But it's slang for vagina. So that rock, the story goes, if you touch it, you become pregnant.
So the women stayed away from that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's true. I touched it, but luckily that didn't happen. So, and again, at the time we were walking around seeing these, I mean, I had no idea what any of this meant. It took me years for it to sink in and realize that this site was a fertility site, a goddess site. Yeah, because there was the one Takai and Pasu on the road, but then there was another even larger one in the central core of the site where these huge megaliths were grouped. Huh. So, and then when I went back in 2018, I was hoping to get more photographs, but everything was so overgrown. I only found the largest stone. It was impossible. And, but I did near the road, I found a new stone that I hadn't seen before. And it was shaped literally like a clam, and on the side, you know, it's rounded oval, and mm-hmm. then on the side etched in, it wasn't a petroglyph, but it was like scallops etched into the side of the stone.
Oh, wow.
So that makes three vagina stones, if you will, at the site. And the one, and who knows what else is there.
Right.
And so, and if the site was older, that would make sense, you know, from an older ancient mother culture, mm-hmm. that there would be goddess, indications of goddess culture.
Well, I'm going to just show some pictures here for the people that are listening. It's a wall. It looks like a window. I'm curious, was this built to protect them from like neighboring islands? Or because sometimes when they, I mean, some of these walls are huge, and the purpose of building these walls are either to keep people out or protecting from maybe hurricanes. I don't know. What is the idea of so many, looks like a city, and even, and goes into this mysterious city. Like there's a map of what it possibly looked like back in the day. I don't know. Could you explain some of these pictures?
Sure.
And your theory and other people's theory on that?
Well, there's a lot of, I mean, there are a lot of theories about it, and it's still somewhat mysterious because what would motivate them back in ancient times to build such a place?
Yeah.
Why? It had to be really, really important, right?
Right.
So, I mean, the common conventional explanation, it was built as a administrative center and tombs. You know, whenever there's a question, it's always a tomb.
Right, right.
Well, and more recently, yes, they were used for tombs. But the Namdal, again, there are many timelines and many versions of its oral history. And unfortunately, with the recent publicity, now that it's more well-known, it's sort of summarized and everyone kind of accepts the same legends. And I think there's way more to it. The common, and it's not that it isn't an accurate oral history. At one point, these two, some call them twin brothers, giants, magicians, came to Pohnpei and they wanted to build a ceremonial site, an administrative site. And they tried in several places. They went around the island. And when they got near the location of Namdal, they climbed the pyramidal peak in that bay that you saw on the map. And from the peak, they saw the city of the ancients under the water. And so that's why they built Namdal where they did, right at the edge of the reef, to be close to the city and to honor it. And did they know about this? Was this what they were always looking for? Did they come back? And the dates usually for this, these two coming and starting the construction of the larger megalithic part was about 900 AD.
I was going to ask the age.
Yeah, that construction lasted most of it 900 to 1100. And however, there are also oral histories from other sources that on that reef, there was some columnar basalt construction before those two arrived.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and nobody ever talks about that. You know, everybody wants to make a neat story, you know.
Right, right.
And they were called the Pali, and they were magicians and engineers, and they were more likely the ones that did the initial layout of Namdal because there were, you know, older structures, basalt structures that were found. And archaeologists from Honolulu, Steve Athens, he found some artifact shell jewelry and adzes and things, and he dated them from 0 to 200 AD. So that's much earlier.
Now, these walls, are those just certain rock, or are they coral, or what did they use to build these walls? Do you know?
Yes, they're all basalt.
Basalt,
and
okay.
They're, they're like rock logs. They're technically they're columnar basalt, and when you see when a volcano cools slowly a certain way, it naturally breaks up in these hexagonal shapes.
Oh, okay.
Like there are places you can see this Devil's Tower, and then where's the place in Devil's Stairway, Causeway in
right.
Scotland, and so on and so forth. And and there are sources, there are several sources on the island for this basalt, and archaeologists have found, you know, they've proven that. And of course, the common remarks are just, oh, they all came from this one mountain, and some of them did, to Pusin Malak, which is a volcanic stub, or what, there's a word for it, can't think of it. Anyway, so, and they were, the construction, it's like, it's called cribbing, when they stack, you know, one row this way and right. one row that way. And there's not really an example of that elsewhere in the world. And Gunung Padang in Indonesia is a huge pyramidal site, and they use a lot of columnar basalt, but they don't stack it that way. And so when you see those walls, they're built, there are 100 islets in Namadal, like you say, it's a city, and mm-hmm. or like a Venice, really.
Right.
And so the base is on the reef, and then they did basalt perimeter, and then they filled it with coral, and then on top of the coral they built the walls and the structures.
Oh, wow. Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, we've talked many times about the pyramids in Egypt, and, you know, how did they build them? And, you know, a lot of people try to contribute it to alien technology. You know, we don't know, but mm-hmm. but sure. they had thousands and thousands and thousands of men and laborers to help. I can't imagine building, I mean, some of these walls, how many people did they expect that lived on this island? Because there was no, you know, technology at that time to lift.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You know, all these rock into this formation. I mean, how, I just can't imagine to do that all by hand. And, you know, how did they build that? And like I said, how many people did they expect to live there at one time?
Well, I'm trying to remember what the archaeologists estimated at one point in time. The royalty lived there in the priesthood, and then the commoners lived on the island and brought food and water.
Oh, okay.
So maybe 10,000 people involved. So a lot. However, still, the source of this columnar basalt, most of them on the far side of the island. And they did some tests with putting them on rafts, and so they floated them up. Well, you know, 20 tons on a raft
right.
in a shallow reef of 4 feet deep or something, you know. However, the Pohnpei oral history is very explicit about that, and there's a lot of agreement that the magicians that worked there, they flew the stones through the sky.
Oh, see, now we're getting back to the UFO technology.
Or advanced human civilization.
Or advanced
human,
yeah.
You know, and in Tibet, you know, there's diagrams of how they levitate. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's okay. That woke me up.
Yeah, me too. Okay, here we go. Oh, sorry. That's what happened.
Okay. There we go.
Back to work.
Back to work.
So yeah, their oral history, they used magic, and there's a name for that. They have a number of different kinds of magic, and they have different names for different kinds of magic. This particular kind of magic is making things lighter. Their minds to control the molecular makeup somehow.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. That is interesting. And, wow.
Yes. And it was when I was living there the second time, it was in the 90s. And before I moved back, I became addicted to sacred sites and researching all this stuff. And a friend of mine was, before the road was built, everybody had outboards, you know, little boats, and that's right. How you pretty much got around. Anyway, and there, so we're going to go somewhere, and he picks up the 30 horse Johnson motor and puts it on his shoulder and walks down the road with it.
Oh my
and
gosh.
I'm going, how did you do this? And he says, oh, we know how to make things lighter.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
I think this is more compelling than almost Egypt, because not saying it is, like you said, alien technology, but also, like you said, we've heard many times about, oh my gosh, don't you hate you when you get that middle age memory?
Welcome to my world.
Right. Atlantis, you know, we've talked about her hearing Atlantis having way advanced technology for what probably should have been. And of course, when it was lost, probably in a flood or earthquake or whatever, greed, it was lost. So this also could have, like you said, petroglyphs from all over the world showed up there, you know. So I think that's interesting how this can lead back to what we started with earlier. And I'm going to show this one thing, and I don't want to jump ahead here, but what is this here that caught my eye? Is that part of the petroglyphs? And
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, this says Pompad petroglyphs. And this was a part of that picture. So I didn't know if that was something that you know anything about. Because I'm like, if that was footprints or handprints, that sure doesn't look like humans.
On the cover of the book?
No. This was just, I was just looking through Google, and it was showing like petroglyph photos.
Well, I don't know. And it looks like rock art, but I don't ever recall anything like that.
Okay, good. Cause I was like, man, if those are footprints or handprints, they sure ain't human.
Right. There is a footprint on the outcrop behind you, which is typical at sacred sites and various places. It's a common petroglyph. But I wanted to mention,
sure,
you mentioned Atlantis and this advanced technology that, you know, that's what the book is about, the legacy of this being in the Pacific, because it started in the Pacific. And, you know, as the Atlantic, it's the counterpart of Atlantis, Mu, in the Pacific, Lemuria or Mu. And it was first.
Oh, wow.
And it was it was a huge landmass in the Pacific, and there were migrations and colonies. And Atlantis, I believe, and others do as well, that Atlantis was initially a colony of Mu. And it was influenced hugely by Mu. And so that's how I feel these petroglyphs at Pompeii they're universal, because they were part of the mother culture, the start of all of this, and then it radiated out in all directions and was, you know, changed slightly here, you know, as it went and as time passed, of course. So, and the other difference between Mu, Lemuria, and Atlantis would be that Mu was a matriarchy. a matriarchal culture, a goddess culture, and therefore less warlike, more balanced, and artful, peaceful nature lovers. And so then when those from Mu, and not to say there weren't others there from who knows where,
you're right.
But that civilization was a little more patriarchal and became more left-brained. And so it's an interesting comparison. And I believe that the Namdal site, you saw the, you know, it's a very, to me, it's a masculine site.
Very masculine, yeah. Like almost, yeah. Like I said, the walls, like, you know, keep people out. And, you know, it was very, yeah.
Yeah. It's not a friendly place in that energetically to me. I mean, it's better than it used to be, but you go to some other, like the pyramids or Machu Picchu or stuff.
Right.
I mean, it's a very uplifting kind of energy. And for me, Namdal is a little not like that.
Well, do you think, and we've talked about this many times, you know, since 2012, the Mayan calendar, how, you know, a lot of people were waiting for like a big bang or something to be present, you know, present in the dimensions. But I think it's a slow transition of, you can definitely feel there's a transitioning into something. And a lot of people think it is into the feminine goddess coming back into power versus the masculine, which have been in power for a long time, as we can see the wars that have been over the thousand or so, so many years. What is your take on that when you were doing the research for this? Like you said, because honoring the feminine side of this, what is your motivation in publishing your new findings about the petroglyph site? Is this something that you're showing that even though Namdal was very masculine, other forms, maybe the petroglyphs, showed a softer side?
Well, yes, and they, I believe, predated Namdal. And, you know, I think all of this is important to study our past, because, I mean, the point is not the matriarchy, the domination part. It's like, is the goal is balance. And so we see in history the different extremes.
Right.
And probably Mu was at one point midway, very balanced and very, and then it, you know, maybe got a little bit too matriarchal for its own good. So we can learn from that. And the other important component of this, of the petroglyph site, Namdal, and the city under the water, Kanyweso. I believe that was the first significant site there at that location. And then when it sank, those, whether they were descendants or there was knowledge that this place used to be there, and they came back and built Namdal near there. But the petroglyph site, I mean, I think it's so old that that's why nobody remembers it or even connects it. And it might have been the mountaintop temple for the city under the water.
Was there, with the connection to other civilizations and cultures, was there one in particular that they noticed more than others from around the world?
You mean in the petroglyph?
Yeah, comparison? In the petroglyph side.
Well, that was just my...
Oh, your take on it?
Yeah, because, well, professionally, for many, you know, I owned a branding marketing business and I designed symbols.
Oh,
so you were... So I have an eye for symbols. And so I would see the similarities. And the only... No one has done any kind of comparing with these... with the new petroglyphs at Pohnpei. The envelope cross that is found there, that's one petroglyph that's found in Melanesia, in New Caledonia. But as far as some of the other one, and then there's a compass similar to a Carolinian navigational compass that the seafarers used to use, well, still do.
Is that the cross? But,
yes. I'm not sure who the gentleman is.
I know.
And that cross has two outlines. And there are some with one outline, two outlines, three outlines at the Pohnpei site. So that is found other places in the Pacific, well, in Melanesia. And the question you ask, what other culture was more like? That cross represents something that that's found worldwide, but mostly in the Americas. I mean, mostly in terms, I can say that what I've researched and what I've found, and Native Americans, North and South and Central America, all use that symbol. And sometimes it's called the Venus cross. Hmm. Sometimes it's called the Quetzalcoatl cross.
And what is, so, I know what it means to Americans and, well, a lot of Christians in the world. I know what the cross means. But what would something like this mean? I mean, I know it's hard to, like, decipher something so old. But what does this mean to a lot of cultures that really didn't really celebrate Christianity?
Well, first of all, it's not the same as a Christian cross,
right?
Because it's equilateral. And that, you know, that equilateral cross, sometimes it's in within a circle, which is also found at Pohnpei. And it can, it's like our typical symbol for the sun, for the four directions, for like I said, for it has some kind of connection with Venus or Quetzalcoatl.
Right.
And so it's a universal symbol, and especially when it's when the equilateral cross is within a circle. So it really doesn't have anything to do with Christianity.
Right. Because a lot of people, I mean, would probably go instantly go to that and go, oh, it was, you know, Christians came to the island and
No. And unfortunately, I mean, my whole, you know, one of the motivations for writing this book and sharing this, I waited a long time, but I figured, well, no one else is going to do it, I'm going to have to do this, is to most Pohnpeians, they don't know these petroglyphs exist. And when I went there, and because, you know, within 6 months, the site was overgrown when we found it, and so, or rediscovered it. And so when I went back in 2018, I wanted to take more photographs, but, and I went and I showed the photographs I had. I showed it to the local king, to the governor, to, handful of dignitaries, you know, historic preservation officers. Nobody had seen these before, even the king.
What? And, oh my gosh.
Yes. Because when I found them, I mean, when we, I should say, rediscovered that, I mean, no, but like I said, the family didn't, you know, there were some rocks in the middle, but they were not significant to them because it wasn't part of their culture. And so, and that tells me how old it was, because Pacific Islanders are really good at oral history and memorizing generations and all, and that it's an art form there. And for them not to have any clue what these are about.
Because even the Egyptians, I mean, they take great pride. And, you know, these 10,000-year-old structures. And, yeah, I'm surprised that they don't keep that.
And interestingly enough, well, when I I was with this professor from ANU when we found them. And then later, you know, my student, while I was in the Peace Corps, he was a historic preservation officer on Pompeii. And he was involved with a nonprofit and everything. And so I said, look, Messi, you've got to go. I've got to show you this. You've got to see these things. And it took a lot of talking to get him out there because he thought it was just the same ones that everyone had seen before on the outcrop. So finally I got him out there and he was just, he'd never seen them either.
Oh, really?
No. And the National Historic Preservation, as of 2018, I showed them. He had never seen them before. And, you know, I'm not an archaeologist and I'm not, you know, I can't, you know, as far as funding or anything like that, it's I was there for a month in 2018, but I wasn't able to. You know, things move slowly. First, you have to get the funding to get the site cleared. And I have no money to do that. So,
well, somebody in the chat room, and actually it does kind of remind me in some ways, not saying it is, but kind of the Knights Templar, you know, their cross. This is one of their, and I know that's a lot of Christianity, but I mean, it does have a little bit of similarity to.
Well, yes. And where did the Knights Templar come from? That's my point.
Right, right. Exactly.
This stuff was first because Knights Templar, you know, they were Johnny come lately. So
right.
To speak.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of spiritual symbolism tied into that. And, you know, along the, you know, over the deck, the millennia gets mixed in with Christianity and so on and so forth.
Wow. Was there any, like, I know there's petroglyphs, but was there any type of tablets or anything that of the language itself other than the petroglyphs itself? No? No?
Well, first of all, there was no written language. Well, in Mu and Lemuria, it was telepathic. There was no written language.
Right.
And then the modern day islanders, of course, they have. I mean, Pompeii, in the oral history and so forth, they didn't have a written language until fairly recently.
Wow.
So, yeah. And these, again, nobody, even the well-known petroglyphs, nobody's really attempted to, you know, interpret them.
I may have to. Do you know Scott Walter? Scott Walter, he's a forensic geologist. And he had a show called American Unearthed on the History Channel and the Travel Channel. And he goes and carbon dates, you know, all these different stones and petroglyphs. And he's now a very well known Templar, a Knights Templar. And so he's amazing, and he discovers so many amazing stories about stuff around the world. I think this would be one for him to maybe get involved with you on, because I think he would bring some good attention to it.
Yes. Well, that would be awesome. I mean, and that's part of the reason for doing this book, to professionals that can do those things. I can't do them. I mean, I have my theories and I've done my research, but that's, you know, what's underneath that huge phallic stone? I mean, what if it was standing upright?
Right.
I mean, it could have more. I mean, who knows what's at the site? And I believe there is a stone circle there.
Oh, my gosh. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. And but it's like when I was there before, there were no helicopters. Well, there still aren't. And so you can't get an aerial photo.
Yeah.
Well, and I went up in a small plane, but it's all jungle, so you can't see anything. So LIDAR and this, all of these new technology, I mean, that's what really needs to happen there. And I hope someone will hear about this and be wanting to do that.
Well, this would be a great, and even right, Ancient Aliens, they're always looking for, you know, the show Ancient Aliens, they're looking for, like you said, something that's baffling like this. Even somebody in the chat room says, Carol, you're on to something here. And also, it's amazing that experts are baffled. So, and even the culture, the people that live there are baffled. That's what's amazing about it. It's like, we don't know. We don't know who these people were. So, Well, we're almost out of time, but what is your takeaway from how important this discovery is, and you know, how can it help us as a human race understand where we came from?
Well, first of all, just to open minds about our past, and that, you know, it wasn't always a bunch of savages running around. I mean, right. There was some very highly advanced technologies and skills that were once known. And it would be probably very helpful for us to know some of them these days. And again, the message of this site, because I believe it's a fertility goddess site, that was an earlier culture, and there's also much we can learn from that as well. And again, the idea of balance, because like you said, like our world today is a little not quite so balanced in terms of matriarchy, patriarchy.
Right.
And I'm so addicted to this site and so excited about it. It's hard for me to be rational, but the thing is that they're all the petroglyphs, Namadal, and the city under the water. I believe that needs to be researched as a complex of three components.
Well, what kind of popped into my head, and the Anunnaki, you know, they talked about how the alien race came down and used humans to mine, and then they bred with the locals. Mm-hmm. And you're saying this is a fertility clinic, and we have magicians that levitating and mind mm-hmm. telepathic, and you're like, I mean, I'm not trying to make this a whole big ancient alien show, but I mean, it for people that, you know, do have questions about our existence and where we came from, this is very fascinating. So yeah, this might be you might maybe get some exposure from this. So
well, and you know, certainly you can't rule that out. I mean, there were stargazers, and there was astronomy going on, and there's a doorway into this huge rock. That's a portal. So
did you go in?
Well, when I knew enough to know what a portal was, well, the first time when I was in the Beast Guard, I had no clue about what that meant.
Right.
And then the second time I was focused on the new area.
Well, maybe you go up and you knock three times, kick the bottom latch, and maybe it opens it up. Maybe it's a secret knock that opens the portal. Well, somebody was asking, are you going to be doing a book signing anywhere? Or because I think they're enjoying your book and also your research and bringing something new to the table.
Well, I would love that, but... because I live in Ecuador, it's a little tricky.
Yeah, a little harder.
A little harder. And, you know, the old days of publishers funding these tours and book, you know, that's that's a thing of the past. And I don't know. I would love to do that, especially in a location that there are a lot of people interested in this type of thing. But before... I really am focusing now on doing my next book specifically on Namadal Revealed. So once it's like giving birth, you know,
I can't wait.
So I don't know, but when and if that happens, I will certainly, you know, publicize that. And one thing that I'm hoping, but it's not till 2024, the Festival of the Pacific happens every 4 years in the Pacific, and it's on a particular island, and it changes every year. And everyone comes, you know, all the Pacific Islands are represented.
Right.
And often a lot of them come on canoes.
Oh, really? Oh, how fun.
Yes, the navigators. And in 2024, it's going to be in Honolulu. So... That's a long ride
on a canoe.
Yeah, from Ecuador. Yeah,
Well, Carol, thank you so much. Unfortunately, our time is up, but you're going to have to come back when you get your second book done, because I'm sure we're going to, and I'll try to connect you with Scott and maybe a few other people that might be able to shed some light on some of this. Because it's rare that we find new things all the time, and now with actually the climate changing and things drying up, a lot more discoveries have been happening around the world. So, you never know what's going to show up. So, but thank you so much for sharing your story and your journey with us, and please come back anytime.
Okay. Well, thank you, Tony.
Of course, and I know you have a Facebook page, but is there any other places people can find you, a website or just?
Not yet. Just my, the Petroglyphs of New Moo Facebook page. And again, because, I'm just focusing elsewhere. And hopefully in the next few months, there will be a real official website.
Perfect. Well, let us know and we'll post that on this link. Okay. for the show. But thank you so much, and come back anytime. And everybody, check out the book. Get the book on, I think, Simon & Schuster and Amazon and bookstores, I'm sure. And please, let's support Carol as much as we can. And thank you guys so much for tuning in and being a part of the show. And please watch Robert Hensley every Monday for Minuteman Report. Bonnie Burkett, that does her show Wednesdays at 3 p.m. called Truth Be Told Transformation. Of course, me here every Friday at 3 p.m. And also, so Truth Be Told and myself, actually, I've put together for all you podcasters in the paranormal genre, coming soon, we're going to be throwing a first-time annual festival award show for the paranormal genre. So more information to come. So please keep an eye out for that. And until next time, I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Like, share, and please leave a comment. Talk to you soon. Bye. This has been another episode of Truth Be Told. Thank you so much for watching. Recorded live at UBN Go Studios in Burbank, California. Join us on social media, Facebook, Truth Be Told Radio, Instagram, Truth Be Told Paranormal. Go to Truth Be Told Worldwide for more information on upcoming shows.